Dogen's vow that we just recited, he says, may all Buddhas and ancestors free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. So today's section of the One Bright Pearl. Slightly touches on this issue of karmic effects, which we'll get into when we get to that point. How can we be free from karmic effects? Last couple investigations of this one bright pearl on a bright pearl birthday of Buddha. We're at the section now where Dogen says, thus, though on the surface there may seem to be change or no change, and the interpretation here is enlightenment or no enlightenment, it is the one bright pearl. And this is referring a bit back to yesterday's issue about surface, about the inner lining of the clothing, where the jewel is given to us by a friend when we're drunk. It's sewn into the inner lining of the clothing. It's not just hung on the surface. Going back, Dogen says, its nature is to be attached to the lining of the clothing, so never say that it is attached to the surface. And so now here we have, thus, though on the surface there may seem to be change or no change, it is actually the one bright pearl that's beneath the surface. The one bright pearl at the bottom of the dark ocean under the dragon's chin. But it does appear like there's lots of changes and no changes going on here on the surface where we can observe them, where we seem to be experiencing our life. There may seem to be many things on the surface in the realm of the imputational character. That's what we know, and that's that creates the surface. Our imputations and ideas and names connected with signs, I think we could say, create the surface of this one bright other dependent pearl. The other dependent pearl that is bright through and through at the center, that we can't actually tell whether anything is changing or not in this pearl. But on the surface, we say this is change and this is not change, and you know, I don't know why the interpretation here is enlightenment or no enlightenment. The other translations don't mention that, but that would be an aspect of, on the surface we might think this is enlightenment or this is not enlightenment. we might fall more into the side of thinking this is not enlightenment. But in either case, it would be an imputation upon the surface of one bright pearl. It's really just the one bright pearl. Realizing it is so is itself the one bright pearl. So, this term, it is so, is the term imo. I think Patrick gave a talk on Shobogenzo imo a few weeks back. Another chapter of the Shobogenzo is called imo, usually translated as such or thus. And it seems that imo is a kind of colloquial term in China that means like such. It's not like a Buddhist technical term. Usually when they translate suchness or thusness, ta-ta-ta, they use different characters like shinyo as a technical term. But part of Zen has always been using colloquial terms to weave them into these technical Buddhist concepts. And with, you know, both sides, colloquial meaning and traditional dharmic meaning. And our English word, such and thus, I think have that sense. Those aren't Buddhist technical terms, right? Things are thus. Things are such as they are. It's very nice because it's a very ordinary word that we use all the time. And yet it's also what we've come to in English use to translate ta-ta-ta, suchness or thusness. And so throughout these next sentences, this term emo is going to appear several times. But if we just take it at this point, realizing it is such is itself the one bright pearl. You could take that as realizing that it's the way the previous sentence spoke about it is the one bright pearl, but also realizing that it is suchness is the one bright pearl. And please excuse me for continuing to bring up this nasty three characters of all phenomena. Grid work, background for framework is the word I'm looking for looking at these teachings. But I think just to point out that we can find that framework woven into so many of these Zen stories, I think, in a way that doesn't use those terms, but all three are kind of operating. So in this case, we could say that on the surface, in the imputational character, there may seem to be this or not this, all these dualistic ideas. Actually, it is just the other dependent character, the one bright pearl. And realizing suchness, realizing that the surface changes actually are kind of obscuring the one bright pearl. Then we can see the one bright pearl. Realizing such is itself the one bright pearl. Now we have this issue that is going to keep appearing for the next couple days of or whether suchness is the other dependent character. And so here he's kind of, if we do interpret it this way, well, it almost sounds like the case here. Because they're so, so close. Seeing how the other dependent is free from the imputation, we can see suchness. Seeing suchness, we see how the other dependent is just the other dependent. But I still say those are still seeing two slightly different things. But one implies the other. That's maybe the key point here. One definitely implies the other. The one bright pearl implies, what's it got to do with understanding? And, what's the use of understanding? Understanding is never going to reach this, implies all of this, one bright pearl. It's, one is implicitly not separate from the other. But we need also to look at explicitly at suchness, which is explicitly contradictory to grasping through the imputational character. So, tomorrow's class, I'll bring up this implicit versus explicit issue, as taught in the Yogacara system. The shapes and sounds of the bright pearl are seen in this way, saying to yourself, it is so, do not doubt that you yourself are the bright pearl, by thinking, I am not the bright pearl. So, again, saying to yourself, it is already such, emo, and this great story of Yaoshan, that Dogen bases his Shobogenzo emo on. Is that one day it's actually Yunju, our ancestor, Ungo Doyo Daiyosho, the heir of Dongshan, one day said to the assembly, if you want to attain such a thing, if you want to attain an emo thing, you must be such a person. You must be an emo person. So, and I think that this really works really nice in English, because I think it has both these sides. If you want to, first he talked about, Dogen doesn't quote the story here, but it's something like, you must have a mind like a fan in winter. And various other images. A fan in winter is just this well, it's useless. Why would you need a fan in winter? It's just like sitting there on the shelf, non-doing. They're very creative with these metaphorical images in Zen. I mean, very strange images. Mine like a fan in winter, and a bunch of other stuff about the great non-doing Zen mind. But then if you want to attain such a thing, you must be such a person. So it has this kind of like double meaning, such a thing as this fan in winter, but also if you want to attain suchness. As we chanted this morning in the Fukan Zazengi, this is where Dogen got that line, if you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. It's the same emo. And it's actually, you know, from the story, if you want to attain such, you should practice such right away. And in that translation that we chanted, they translate as suchness. What's our other version we were chanting for a while? It's like, something maybe like we were chanting, if you want such a thing, get to work on such a thing immediately. In San Francisco for a while, we had that translation. If you want such a thing, get to work on such a thing immediately. So if you just heard that, you'd have no idea it was referring to suchness. So this current one that we're doing brings out this, if you want to attain suchness, not just such a thing, but suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. So they both emphasize the technical aspect and the colloquial aspect. There's two different translations. If you want to attain such a thing, you must be such a person. Since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? That's Yunju's story that Dogen comments on, which is a great Zen saying. And I liked Thomas Clear's little introduction here. He talks about how such is this colloquial word. And a lesson might be drawn from the saying is that thusness or suchness is arrived at by merging with it. It is not something obtained externally. Since you are thus, or once you realize you are thus, why worry about thusness as something to attain? This is basic Zen teaching. Basic, but challenging. That which obstructs the consciousness from realizing oneness with thusness is arbitrary conception and false description projected by the mind. Sound like a familiar character in our drama? Hence the saying that one who comprehends has a mind like a fan in winter and a mouth growing mold. And this is again this, that you have nothing to say. There's nothing to say about this. So you're speechless and your mouth has been sitting still for so long it's grown mold from disuse. That might be interpreted as meaning realization of thusness is a matter of not obscuring it by mental construction and fixed labels. Cessation of compulsive mental habits and silencing of the mind are a means of accomplishing this. That's Thomas Cleary. So, as Dogen often does, you know, he'll just like pop in a phrase like that, which doesn't even seem to be the main point that he's talking about, but it's bringing up this other dharmic issue, right? And that's why, you know, taking this apart line by line, we can start to reveal Dogen's effort at making every line count. Making a Dharma statement with each line. So, are says, saying to yourself, it is so, do not doubt that you yourself are the bright pearl by thinking, I'm not the bright pearl. Another translation is, it is precisely knowing that that the jewel has all along been thus, that it is itself the bright jewel. The bright jewel has sound and form, which sounds this way. In being already at thusness, as far as worrying that oneself is not the bright pearl is concerned, one should not suspect that that is not the jewel. Yeah, that's Thomas Cleary is likes these kind of convoluted sentences where you're like, you have to read them multiple times. But I think he's trying to use the language of the story of Yunju in this case, since you already are, and I think that the actual characters have the already part in there too. In being already at thusness, or since you already are such, as far as worrying that oneself is not the bright pearl is concerned, one should not suspect that that is not the jewel. So, since we are such a person, as far as worrying that we're not the bright jewel, we shouldn't suspect that this worrying, that's how I take it, that this worrying that we're not the bright jewel is not the jewel. In other words, since we are already such a person, to take the original story, since you're already such a person, why worry about such a thing? Since we're already such, why worry that we're not the one bright pearl? So he kind of combines these two, right? Or it's a little extra thing in there too, right? Since we're already such, as far as worrying that we're not the bright jewel is concerned, or worrying that we're not such a person, or worrying about such a thing, don't doubt that this worrying that we're not such a jewel is actually the jewel. To put it simply, worrying is the one bright jewel. Yes, and I think it's because he's trying to poetically and prosaically combine these two sayings about the one bright pearl and the and since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? And how you do that in Japanese, I have no idea, but it seems like he's trying to combine those and it makes a kind of clunky sentence. Let's see what Kaz says. This being so, although you may say, I am not a bright pearl, you should not doubt. So he didn't bring up the issue of suchness at all. He skips over this the emo issue. This being so would be the translation of emo. Knowing that the pearl is indeed like this, so that doesn't really emphasize it either, like this, such as this. Knowing that the pearl is indeed like this, that itself is the bright pearl. In this way, the colorations and configurations of the bright pearl are encountered When it is thus, we have thus. When it is thus, there is no reason to doubtingly think that you are not the pearl, because you perplexedly think, I'm not the pearl. But you get the idea. Confusions and doubts, affirmations and negations, these are nothing but the ephemeral small responses of ordinary folk. However, they are the bright pearl appearing as small ephemeral responses. Which is interesting that he doesn't say, they're not really small ephemeral responses, they're great, magnificent, bright pearl radiance. He says, no, they really are small. ephemeral responses, but they're the bright pearl appearing as small ephemeral responses. We don't deny that things can appear smaller, almost like saying, it's not really delusion, it's enlightenment. It's like, no, it is delusion, but it's enlightenment appearing as delusion. Which is kind of nice, because it's totally honoring smallness and illusion, and each obscure thought is as it is in and of itself, is just that. It's just an obscure thought, but we see that it's like an emanation, a manifestation of one bright pearl. Therefore, it is actually a vast, radiant, small, dark response. Yes.
I know that you are alive in the Black Mountain Cave of Demons.
Yes. Yeah. Alive in the Black Mountain Cave of Demons. Mm-hmm. Just Black Mountain Cave of Demons. Just being one of those demons. Or having all those demons having a party in our head. actually... It's the life of one bright pearl. Yes, that very phrase combines both sides. Worrying and doubting, grasping and rejecting, action and inaction are all but temporary views of small measure. What is more, it is merely causing resemblance to small measure. How lovely is one bright pearl's infinite colors and shades. Bits and pieces of its colors and shades are the function of the entire world in 10 directions. Oh, actually, that's the next part. Which is, should we not appreciate it? The bright pearl's colors and brilliance are boundless. Color after color, and every scintillation? Is that how you say it? Scintillation? Which is like shining. What's a scintillation?
Brilliant sparkle.
Color after color, and every scintillation of light are the merit of the whole universe. Could anything ever snatch them away? Would anyone ever toss away even a simple rock tile in the marketplace while looking for the pearl? So, another one says, who can take them away? No one can take it away or throw a tile in the marketplace. So these are two different references here. And the one about taking away is a little obscure, but it seems there is a reference to a Xuanzha story that one footnote makes. So, and because it happens to be Xuanzha, chances are that Dogen picked up on that and just put in this, like, not stealing or taking away as a reference to this story. So, and this story about, this is a new story of Xuanzha. There's many of his stories, right? We've heard a lot already in this Sashim, but here's one that we haven't. First of all, There's two about fire. So one kind of classic story is Shui Feng, remembers Xuan Sha's teacher. Shui Feng said to the assembly, "All Buddhas in the three worlds are turning the Dharma wheel in the middle of fierce flames or fire." That's what he said. And what's fierce flames? Well, it could be anything. It could just be the one bright pearl. It could be energy. But also, I feel it has this sense of like the burning world, the painful heat of anger and afflictions and you know, the mind that's not like cool at rest, the mind that's on fire with distress. That's how I take the fierce flames here. That all Buddhas of the three times are turning the Dharma wheel in the middle of fierce flames. And Xuan Sha, who's maybe in the assembly, responds by saying, "The fierce flames expound the Dharma for all Buddhas in the three times." And all the Buddhas stand there and listen. So this is, we were talking yesterday a little bit about how, you know, we are encompassed by the bright pearl, we're living in the bright pearl, and also the bright pearl's in us, and what was Johnny's phrase? He had this two-sided expression about you know, like kind of like we're creating it and it's creating us. It's the donkey looking at the well and the well looking at the donkey. All these two sides. So this is kind of like that. All Buddhas are teaching Dharma in the middle of these fierce flames. And then the other side is the fierce flames are teaching Dharma to the Buddhas. And the Buddhas standing there and listening. It's like... it's the receptive side, I see it as. It's like, instead of like, and as a practice point, it's like, well, we could go, so we have our fierce flames, right, during Zazen. We can go in there and try to be Buddha, right, and turn the Dharma wheel for ourselves and all beings in the middle of our fierce flames, silently during Zazen. We can, in other words, we can say to ourselves, like, okay, just relax here. And maybe if we can relax there. Still fierce flames. Okay, let's start looking at these fierce flames. Could they actually be bright jewel flames? Yes. Come on, they're bright jewel flames. It's like we can become Buddha and give ourselves a Dharma talk in the middle of those flames. Or we can just let those flames give the Dharma talk to us, and we can just stand or sit there and listen. The flames are saying, here we are very strong and hot and painful, aren't we? But also, you're welcome to check out what we are. You're welcome to look at our characteristics here, but we're going to make it very hard for you because we're fierce. And we're going to try to distract you in every way we can from actually examining what we are. We're going to be so hot that you're just going to want to get away from us. And you're not going to want to just sit here and listen to our Dharma. But actually, we're telling you the Dharma of three characteristics as we're burning you up. And you're welcome to just sit here and listen to it.
Dogen goes into that in one of his fascicles, the awesome something of an enlightened Buddha.
Conduct, maybe.
He goes, he takes that story
the flames. Oh. I don't think we have it here. Yo Butsu Yo Igi. Yeah, I'll have to look at that. So all Buddhas in the three worlds turn the Dharma wheel in the midst of the fire. The fire expounds the Dharma to all Buddhas, and the Buddhas stand there and listen. So that's one story about the Buddhas teaching in the middle of fierce flames that Shui Feng brought up and Xuan Sha responded to. Now I have another similar story, maybe some other time, that Shui Feng pointed his finger at a furnace and said to Xuan Sha, his student, all Buddhas in the three worlds are in here turning the great Dharma wheel. Basically same thing, but now he's actually pointing to a particular furnace. What are you going to say when somebody says something like that, right? Oh, excuse me, I have something to tell you. Come here. Can you come here a second? You think maybe he's going to say, the heater's broken, could you work on it? The thermostat's loose. And so he says, actually, all Buddhas of the three worlds are in here turning the great Dharma wheel. But Shui Feng, who had a similar style, immediately responded, the king's regulations are rather strict. And Shui Feng maybe was startled by that and said, oh, how so? And Xuan Sha said, stealing is not permitted. Now, I think this is a strange story. What kind of stealing is going on here? The king, if we say the Dharma king, the Buddha, his regulations are rather strict. He says, do not steal, do not take what's not given. But how does that apply here? The Buddha's teaching the Dharma in there, and teaching this precepts, not stealing. So is there something about the way that Shui Feng is pointing with his finger and saying, the Buddhas of the three worlds are in here? Is there something that's like stealing about that? And how would that apply to the Buddhas in the furnace? And so would you say maybe like then we can't just say, oh, these flames of daily life are just Buddha, so just forget about it. That'd be kind of like stealing. Like we're gonna receive the effect of the flames.
Or saying this isn't the realm of practice.
So stealing would be like trying to steal a cool breeze.
Yeah.
When the flames are happening. Interesting. No, I could see it. I actually, this is a story where I and not finding an entry. Mm-hmm. So I could see that actually that's one way to say it. Now we do have Daito Lori Roshi's verse. This, because this story appears in the 300 koan collection of Dogen. So whether this helps us or not, and this is his interpretation, he just says, Shui Feng, who, you know, pointed with his finger, is clearly a thief who steals in broad daylight. Clearly, right? So he does seem to be pointing towards, at least this is how he's taking it, he seems to be pointing towards some kind of theft going on with Shui Feng's statement. But Xuan Sha steals the thief's horse and pursues him. So we heard about that image yesterday. Commonly appears in Zen as stealing the thief's horse to chase the thief. So it finally comes down to just two monks playing with mud balls. A common image, playing with mud balls. After all, sweet is just sweet, bitter is just bitter. So, Daito Roshi, as an American Zen teacher, commenting in the classical way, also doesn't give us much of a gateway. we have to work with that. And he asks in his commentary, what's the stealing here? This issue about stealing. Now we have another translation says, plundering the marketplace. And I don't know if the original has anything about marketplace. The king's regulations are rather strict. How so? Plundering the marketplace is not permitted. The marketplace of fierce flames. Or is there something about, which constantly seems to be an issue in these stories, about pointing? And the translation even says, pointed with his finger. So it's really making this issue about, he's not even just saying something about Buddha, but he's pointing with his finger and saying they're in here. Now the strict Dharma king doesn't like pointing. That's why when Manjushri pointed to the Buddha in the first case of the Book of Serenity and said, the Dharma king of the Dharma of the Dharma king is thus, it is such, then the Dharma king got down and left. He's like, I don't like you pointing like that. So, stealing, plundering, is a funny image, right? There's different criticisms. If the issue is about pointing, there's different things we could say other than stealing. So Dogen says here, his issue is, he's talking about color after color and every scintillation of light are the merit of the whole universe. Could anything ever snatch them away? Could anything ever steal them? If we take it as pointing, could anything ever actually limit them by pointing to that color and saying it's the bright jewel? Could the imputation of bright jewelness ever could the fingertip of the imputation of bright jewelness ever actually touch the bright jewel? Touch and strongly adhere to it? And then would anyone ever toss away even a simple rock tile in the marketplace while looking for the pearl? So, only, you know, it's nice we have these different translations because they all have different footnotes, and I think some of them just never realized there were these references, and some did, but they all refer to different things, right? So, between them all, they cover a lot, but I'm sure they didn't get them all. Thomas Cleary says, casting a tile to draw a piece of jade means to give a little to get more. And this comes from this old Chinese, probably not a Zen story, but just a folk story. Someone once posted two lines of a verse in a temple, maybe it's saying, where a famous poet was expecting to visit, provoking the poet to complete the verse. So, like, poets can't stand not, like, finishing a verse. So, they said, this famous poet's coming, and, like, let's get him to write a cool verse. We'll start a poem here, and he'll be compelled to finish it, because that's how poets are. provoking him to complete the verse. The lines added by the poet were superior, which maybe was the person was hoping for. He'll write some really great lines. And the man who wrote the first two lines was said to have thrown a tile and drawn in a piece of jade. So you get a sense of that. You know, I'm not really a poet. I just want to hear some great poetry from this poet. So I'm just going to write some, you know, very ordinary poetry, first two lines. And then, sure enough, the poet came and wrote these brilliant poetic lines to finish the poem. So I just had to throw in, we're like playing this game here, like I'm just throwing a piece of tile and actually I'm getting this amazing jade gemstone in response. Or as Cleary says, to give a little to get a lot. Giving a little and getting a lot is the image. So would anyone ever toss away even a simple tile in a marketplace while looking for the pearl? Or, there is no one casting a tile in the marketplace. Because actually the thing about the pearl is just in parentheses. Cleary, who made the footnote, just says, there is no one casting a tile in the marketplace. And it follows right after, who can take them away or steal them? Well, actually, he says, each flicker, each beam, each light is a quality of the whole world in the 10 directions. Who can take them away? Who can steal away all that, you know, the shimmerings, the manifestations of the bright jewel? In parentheses, we could say, by pointing at them, would be one interpretation. Who can, like, destroy this amazing manifesting world by, like, saying, look, it's this or it's that. And there's no one casting a tile in the marketplace. There's no one casting a tile. How can you hear it? Could it be that it's like, no one's trying to make a deal here. We're just like, jade comes as a gift of the one bright pearl. Jade is always being given to us, and we don't have to like play this game of this person who's like, the great poet is coming, right? The Buddha is coming. Let's, the bright pearl is coming. So let's try to, you know, lay out a little trap to catch some of it. Like, we don't need to do that. That'd be one interpretation, right? The jade is coming. It doesn't mention that. It just says, there's no one casting a tile in the marketplace. Maybe we could translate it as like, don't bother casting a tile in the marketplace. You don't need to draw in the jade. seems like cause maybe doesn't refer to the story. He just says, no one can take it away or throw a tile at it in the marketplace. Don't throw a tile at the bright pearl. You might scratch it.
A common technique in writers' groups where you have a bunch of writers sitting around, you start it off, but someone throws up a sometimes meaningful phrase, and everybody sits and writes. And you come up with, you know, very interesting.
All kinds of surprising things, huh? Yeah, and I think a lot of these Zen dialogues, you could say, are like, and that's probably why it became a Zen phrase, is that, like, you know, to say, you know, Shui Feng saying, let's, I feel like creating a cool Zen dialogue. If it's cool enough, maybe it'll be recorded and we'll read it 800 years from now, or, you know, 1,000 years from now. So let's do it. Shui Feng would be good to do this with. Hey, Shui Feng, the Buddhas of the three times are teaching Dharma in the middle of this furnace. Now, go for it. Like, give me some jade. And that was kind of jade-like and very, like, unexpected to say. The king's regulations are quite strict. Whoa! I hope Shui Feng appreciated how the spontaneity of such a response. So now we have this issue about cause and effect, and may Buddhas and ancestors free us from our karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. So here we say, now this translation, I'll read it here, but this doesn't really get at it. I think Francis Cook here missed this issue, this really important issue. He says, do not be anxious about being reborn in one of the six realms of cause and effect. The bright pearl, which from beginning to end is essentially uninvolved with cause and effect, is your original face, your enlightened nature. Now, he missed, which seems like when you see the characters, this obvious reference to the story of Baijiang's fox. And I think it's so wonderful to bring this up as the end of this essay approaches, because this is this aspect of the one bright pearl, as, you know, we're talking about it as the other dependent character, dependent co-arising, but just the way that everything is affecting everything and giving rise to the appearance of this ungraspable, mirage-like world. But of course, dependent co-arising has this whole issue of cause and effect and causality. In fact, cause and effect is another name for dependent co-arising. And in the Sandhya Rinpoche in the Sutra, the other dependent character is kind of defined as cause and effect, really. It says, what is the other dependent character? When this arises, that arises. When this comes to be, that comes to be. We haven't been talking about it so much that way. So this is a nice reminder. And whether Dogen was consciously thinking about this one by pearl as dependent co-arising, I don't know, but it looks like this fits in quite wonderfully here, because what we actually have is, here's the, maybe people know this story, Baijiang's Fox. Do you know this Baijiang's Fox story?
That was the master that somehow got off the track and became a fox. And
yeah. They might have been, yeah, they like buried the fox body. But the way he got off track is the key thing here. So here's the story. is that Bhaijang would give these Dharma talks, and every day this old man would come to the back of the zendo and sit there, and he'd always leave right at the end of the talk, and never say anything to anybody. But he'd come every talk like that, and no one knew who he was. And so one time he actually waited behind when everybody left, so Bhaijang went up and said, "Who are you anyway? I've been wondering about you." And he said, "Actually, I was the abbot here in the time of Kashyapa Buddha." We say, Kasho Butsu Daiyosho, one of the seven Buddhas before Buddha. So this whole other, like, era, this whole other world system. But I lived here on Mount Bhaijang, actually, and there was a zendo here at the time of Kashyapa Buddha. And one time this monk came to me and said, does a greatly cultivated person, sometimes they say enlightened person, but it's a person of great practice. Daishugyo, so there's a fox on the roof right above your head, Chuck. Maybe you can't see it. Can y'all see it? It's actually a cat. coming to back of the hall to listen to some Dharma. And so at the time of Kashyapa Buddha, I was the abbot here, and this monk came and said, does a greatly cultivated person, a great practitioner who's realized the way, do they fall into cause and effect or not? And particularly, it seems implying karmic cause and effect. Like, if they do something bad, will they, do they have to receive the karmic fruits of that? Or are they totally free from the whole issue? And I said to him, they don't fall into cause and effect. And because of giving that answer, I was reborn as a wild fox for 500 lifetimes. And the implication is that I'm actually a fox right now, and although I look like a person, I kind of like am emanating this person body, but I'm really a fox. And 500 lifetimes is enough. So please, can you give me a turning word to free me from this fox body? A turning phrase. Can you turn my understanding? And so Bhaijang said, a greatly cultivated person does not obscure cause and effect. He just turned one word from not falling into cause and effect to not obscuring cause and effect. And he was, this fox person was greatly awakened upon hearing that. And then there's some follow-up stories about saying, well, now you'll find this dead fox body on the other side of the mountain. Please do a monk's funeral for it. That's my body. I'm free. And then there's some interesting stories about what Huangbo makes of this, involving some slapping. But the basic story is when I said an awakened person doesn't fall into cause and effect, I basically fell into cause and effect big time for 500 lives. I received this karmic effect of a fox body. And when I heard enlightened person doesn't obscure cause and effect, or another translation is not blind to cause and effect, I was released from my twisted karma. So, not the turning phrase is not falling and not blind or not obscuring. So, Thomas Cleary's translation of this section here about after there's no one casting a tile into the marketplace, don't bother about not falling into or not being blind to the cause and effect of mundane existences. The unclouded, original bright jewel, which is true through and through, is the face. The bright jewel is the eyes. So it actually does say six worlds, and I think that's what he's translating as mundane existences. So you could say, don't bother about not falling into or not being blind to the cause and effect of birth in the six realms of sentient beings. Kaz Ta-Nehisi says, do not be concerned about falling or not falling into cause and effects in the six paths. Not ignoring cause and effect from beginning to end is the face of the bright pearl, is the eye of the bright pearl. I think he hit it most directly in this case, Kaz, because it actually says, falling and not falling in the Japanese, and then not ignoring or obscuring or now going back to the issue of the one bright pearl as dependent co-arising as cause and effect, the workings of everything is affecting everything else. And do we sometimes wish that we could just be free from that kind of messy situation of cause and effect that we call life? Or another way to put it, in terms of the sutra, the Sandinirmochana Sutra, would be like, well, this other dependent is like a mirage and like the appearance of our life. Even though it's just a mirage, it's still a little bit more messy than the thoroughly established total emptiness. So, wouldn't we like to eliminate the imputational character and maybe even the other dependent character and just bask in the thoroughly established character of nothing happening, total cessation? Don't be concerned about falling or not falling into cause and effect in the six paths. Or an enlightened person, it's not that they don't fall into the bright pearl, or they're somehow free of the bright pearl, or that they're free of the other dependent character. That's the beauty of these three characters, is that they're always all three happening. That realizing the thoroughly established doesn't mean eliminating the other dependent. And again, this is going back into the sutra a little, maybe too much, but that's part of the reason for this teaching of these three characters as a response to Prajnaparamita that just teaches emptiness or something like the thoroughly established. It sounds like in the end there's nothing, there's no eyes, no ears, no nose. And I thought of this morning about the Heart Sutra and this issue of we're talking about too, about the difference between emptiness and dependent arising. And I thought of that line, therefore, you know, in emptiness, how does ours go? Therefore, given emptiness, there is no, is it arising or birth, or what do we say there? Therefore, given emptiness, there is no, oh no, that's later. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, emptiness is not separate from form, form is not separate from emptiness. Oh, there, that's it, that's the one, yeah. All dharmas are defined by emptiness. Not birth or destruction. that in particular, and another, I think the translation we said before was, all dharmas are marked by emptiness, they neither arise nor cease. Birth and arising are same. So, and also this is a nice thing because marked by, we're getting, this is tangential here, marked by is the same, is, the mark means character, is lakshana in the Heart Sutra. All dharmas have this mark or characteristic of emptiness. And the sutra is now saying, Sanjana Moja is saying that that's the mark of, you could say, the thoroughly established. But in emptiness, there's no arising and no ceasing. So therefore, to say that emptiness is dependent arising, we can't quite say that, right? Because in emptiness, and I think that's one of the more radical lines that's easy to just chant through in the sutra, but in emptiness, there's nothing is arising. Independent co-arising, that's what it is. It's arising by, in its very definition. It's the arising, but in, you know, dependent on everything else. The interdependent arising, but it's the arising aspect. It's the mark of arising, the characteristic of arising, but in a very unfixed way, and completely momentary and unreified arising. But in emptiness, there's no arising. Yeah, there is no
non-duality.
It's not, we could say it's non-duality, and there's no distinguishing difference between like arising and cessation, for example, and between anything else. But also, if we're saying that, as the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra says, if emptiness is like the way that the imputation of essence doesn't reach the arising, it's like the way that it doesn't reach it, or the absence, again, it's the absence of the imputation in the arising, that absence doesn't arise or cease. Because, and that's why we can, that's why this Sanjay Nirmochana does this, picks up on that point and says, because it doesn't arise or cease, it is thoroughly established in permanent time. Let's double it. Everlasting time. It's like really like, you know, magnifying this thing that's, with these words that are kind of like, you know, red alert words in Dharma, right? Permanent, everlasting. Whoa! Thoroughly established. Wait a second. But actually, if it's just an absence of this ever reaching this, then that absence doesn't arise and doesn't cease. It never, nothing can be done about that absence. Yes?
Would it also be so that if the imputation never reaches, then there is no arising? It's the imputation reaching that makes it arise.
I mean, it's, yeah, we could kind of think that way, except that, but you could say, but as long as you have these three, again, all three are always happening, so you can say, well, what if there was an imputation that never reached it, then there wouldn't be any world? But you couldn't have an imputation in the first place, right, without a world, and you couldn't have the arising, so they're all completely interrelated. It's very dynamic when we try to, like, pinpoint it in one area, then there'll be some contradictory thing somewhere else often. But it's just like, it's about the relation. You could say emptiness is about a relationship of the imputation and the other dependent. And it's just that relationship is kind of like a non-relationship. Or that those two are never obscured. those two are never confused to be the same thing. The Prajnaparamita is much simpler system. It's just like, because it's not explaining it, which is also the problem with a simple system that's not explained. Well, how do we deal with this? What does that mean? That there's like nothing arises and ceases? Is that just some like metaphysical idea? And I think what the Sandhya Ramochana Sutra is saying is, no, it's not just some obscure, metaphysical, mystical idea at all. It's like completely logical. There's logic. The Sandhya Ramochana Sutra is unraveling the mysteries of emptiness. There's this logical basis for that nothing arises. And in order to kind of like show the logic, we're going to set up these three characteristics. But it's difficult logic too. But the more we look at how they work together. So you could say, if there was never any minds, if there was never any other dependent alaya, vijnana, if there was never any sentient beings, then would there be a world? Which is kind of like, does a tree make a sound when it falls in the forest and nobody's there? And kind of the mind-only view, but maybe anyone would say, no, not really a world. I mean, are there other planets with no life on them? Well, in a way, but before there was any consciousness to know that they were there, we can only imagine, because we're conscious beings, that, well, of course, those were there, and then, boom, we have consciousness that knows them in this particular way, that they're round balls of matter in space, the planets. But that's all like human construction. We can't actually get out of human construction to imagine what is there if there was never any construction, if there was never any mind. It's very easy for us to imagine that there was, but it's just our minds doing that. Yeah.
Well, I think in the same vein of really trying to describe something that's undescribable. In the first part, where we're talking about if you want to attain suchness, be such a person, and then you are such a person. There's something, and then he goes on to describe, the beautiful, radiant pearl. If you can realize it, it's beautiful and radiant. There's something that draws us, perhaps, to this total dynamic functioning. We're it all the time, and we can think of it as pretty nice, this interconnectedness and the unity of all things. And yet it also includes pretty ordinary stuff that we don't think about very much, and we're encouraged to do something like practice that will make the ordinary even let us see the radiance of this pearl, or even the black cave. We're imagining this student that's confined to the demon cave is actually pretty excited about, how do I understand this? And of course, you've got the emptiness side that takes all of that away. And you've talked about how Dogen really wants us to see that there's something, that there's not nothing.
Yeah, there's not nothing. There's Yeah, it's two sides of a coin, you could say.
And do we come to the Zen Center, or do people go to Holy Cross because they're, you know, inconceivably kind of pulled to this total dynamic functioning?
Yeah. Probably no one gets pulled into practice through resonance with emptiness. Although, I shouldn't say, I don't know. You know, it may be that, depends how we talk about emptiness. Not about nothingness, but about like, maybe feeling like, I'm starting to see how like everything I think is actually not what's happening. Like, nothing makes sense anymore. Some people, maybe that's kind of like, and I don't know what to make of that. That could be like a kind of an emptiness draw. All the magnificent pearl, in a way, I mean, I've heard people talk this way, is like, emptiness, you know, it's not exactly really emptiness, but something close to the Buddhist emptiness is sometimes people have this feeling of like meaninglessness. And sometimes I feel like it's actually really close, and maybe to the liberating, joyful teaching of emptiness in a Dharma. And like, what's the difference? Maybe just the context, or is the difference the one bright pearl? That's the that is the context actually. It's the one by pearl is empty of our empty of our imputations, and there we're actually left with the one by pearl. And is that meaningless? Ultimately, yes, it's meaningless. And because meaning can be such a burden, but actually just doing, just living this life without trying to attribute some meaning to it, can be the, especially I think we can feel that in Sesshin, like, why are we doing this? It's so painful, and does this really make sense? And like, all the list of logical reasons why I'm doing this no longer holds up, and like, but still, like, there's many more periods to go. So now what? Oh, well, just surrender. And then we have like, it's okay, now it's joyfully meaningless, and it's just doing. It's just having another Oriyoki meal, or it's just hearing some more craziness from Dogen, or it's just more leg pain, meaningless leg pain, but it's won by pearl also. So I don't know. Yeah, I think the positive side is really important. The brightness.
Yes.
Every scintillation of light.
And I think he's telling that to a knowing being. I don't think he's telling this to people who've never heard or felt it before.
Yes.
It's not like he's standing on the corner.
One day pearl! We don't need to cast a tile!
Yeah.
Ah, jade! Yeah.
It's already speaking to that student that's already kind of mulling this around.
Yeah, definitely.
And
that's us, right?
Yeah.
That's why we're doing this. That's why we have a Genzo Rei Sesshin, to appreciate this 800-year-old guy who like doesn't make much sense. It's like, And that's why there's not many people in the room. Well, you know, we can bring it down to downtown, you know, eventually, and set up a soapbox and a microphone. Santa Cruz might be able to deal with it. But yeah, and I think, I mean, in a way, yeah, it is us in a small group who can put up with such stuff. But also, I think when you were saying it's speaking to that in us, I feel like that is actually in everyone. Maybe people, it takes a while to start to open to this kind of language and this kind of presentation of it, but that's like the, I think that's what Dogen's saying too, right? Is that actually, the demons in the dark cave are also the one bright pearl and have some sense of that somehow, maybe. I mean, that's our just trust in Buddha nature, we could say.
And we can't put our finger on exactly where that is or why we first came to the Zen Center.
Yeah, I can't.
Why our parents first went to the Lutheran Church. But there seems to be this kind of lemming migration that we're all prone to.
Yeah. Sometimes I think too, it's like such an unlikely cast of characters too, right? It's like, I mean, we're like this, the one by pearl is what brings us together, you could say. And like, who would have guessed? You know? Then maybe we're interested in computers or boats or something, so we have another group of people that we talk to about those things, but I don't want to diminish those groups too, because they can be really intimate and special too, but to come together around one bright pearl, there's nothing like that, right? This is our life. So beautiful, huh? And what is it? And what's it got to do with understanding? What's it got to do with time? So just to finish this little section about cause and effect, don't bother about not falling into or not being blind to cause and effect of the mundane existences. The unclouded original bright jewel, which is true through and through, is the face. The bright jewel is the eyes. So don't worry about falling or not falling. Just go ahead and fall into the cause and effect of the other dependent one bright pearl, and then we don't have to escape. I mean, that was this fox person, right? Was thinking, wouldn't it be nice to escape causality? But it's just a greatly free being is right in the midst of it, but just not obscuring it. Which was the beautiful answer of, instead of saying, they're not, you know, instead of saying, well, you said that they don't fall into cause and effect, I'm going to turn the word and say, they do fall into cause and effect. Enlightened beings do. He didn't say that, right? He didn't come down one way or the other. They do or they don't. Just don't obscure causality. And of course, you know, we have the connection. If cause and effect is the other dependent character. Don't obscure it with the imputational character obscures the other dependent character. So a nice little part about birth in various realms of cause and effect. Karma, the karmic aspect of the one bright pearl. And so that's what I thought when we were chanting. Buddhas and ancestors, may Buddhas and ancestors free us from karmic effects. And often I heard that, like, well, how could they? We have our own karma. Like, no, Buddhas can't magically erase that and just say, like, you are like absolved of all, you know, all the good and bad things you've done. Like, I just wipe the slate clean. There won't be any effects anymore. Even the Buddhas and ancestors can't do that. But then how can we be like, you know, praying to them, asking them, may they free us from karmic effects? Well, just like this, this person in the back of the hall, right? Please free me from cause and effect. And it looked like he was freed from cause and effect. He was still born again, maybe as a human, and maybe he'd have some more fox lives, but free in the midst of cause and effect. So that's like being able to live in the demon cave as the bright pearl, the free bright pearl manifesting as a dark demon cave. Free in the midst of, like, so one verse in response to this Bai Jiang's fox story mentioned something like 500 lives of grace. This sense that, like, that wasn't a problem, you know, that he had these 500 lives as a fox. That was just the playing out of causality, the playing out of the karmic aspect of dependent co-arising. And so just be a fox for 500 lives, it's okay. And all the retribution that's coming to me from obscuring Dogen and the Buddha Dharma through, I'm willing to receive it. Bring it on. I vow to practice in that whatever realm I will end up in. May all beings not obscure cause and effect, and take a deep swan dive into it, swimming laps back and forth, lifetime after lifetime, in the one bright pearl ocean. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings